started with the bears, whose movements had grown more and more frantic until Lacey had pulled Amy away from the glass, and then, behind them, the sea lions, who began to hurl themselves in and out of the water with manic fury. And as they turned and dashed back toward the zoo's center, the grassland animals, the gazelles and zebras and okapis and giraffes, who broke into wild circles, running and charging the fences. It was Amy who was doing it, Lacey knew. Something about Amy. Whatever had happened to the polar bears was happening to everything now, not just the animals, but the people, too, a ring of chaos widening over the entire zoo. They passed by the elephants, and at once she felt their size and force. They stomped the ground with their immense feet and lifted their trunks to trumpet into the Memphis heat. A rhino charged the fence, a huge noise like a car crashing, and began furiously to bang it with his massive horn. The air was suddenly swollen with these sounds, great and terrible and full of pain, and people were tearing about and calling out to their children, pushing and shoving and pulling, the crowds parting for Lacey as she raced ahead. "That's her!" a voice rang out, and the words struck Lacey from behind, hit her like an arrow. Lacey spun to see the man with the camera pointing a long finger right at her. He was standing beside a security guard in a pastel yellow jersey. "That's the kid!" Still clutching Amy, Lacey turned and ran, past cages of shrieking monkeys, a lagoon where swans were honking and flapping their huge, useless wings, tall cages erupting with the cries of jungle birds. Terrified crowds were pouring out of the reptile house. A group of panicked schoolchildren in matching red T-shirts stepped into Lacey's path, and she twisted around them, nearly falling but somehow staying upright. The ground before her was littered with the debris of flight, brochures and small articles of clothing and blobs of melting ice cream stuck to paper. A group of men tore past, breathing hard. One was carrying a rifle. From somewhere a voice was saying with robotic calm, "The zoo is now closed. Please move quickly to the nearest exit. The zoo is now closed." Lacey was going in circles now, looking for a way out, finding none. Lions were roaring. Baboons, meerkats, the monkeys she'd listened to from her bedroom window on summer nights. The sounds came from everywhere, filled up her mind like a chorus, ricocheting like the sound of gunfire. Like the gunfire in the field. Like her mother's voice crying from the doorway, "Run away! Run away as fast as you can!" She stopped. And that was when she felt it. Felt him. The shadow. The man who wasn't there, but also was. He was coming for Amy. Lacey knew that now. That's what the animals were telling her. The dark man would take Amy to the field where the branches were, the ones Lacey had watched for hours and hours as she lay and looked at the sky as it paled from night to morning, hearing the sounds of what was happening to her and the cries coming from her mouth. But she had sent her mind away from her body, up and up through the branches to heaven, where God was. And the girl in the field was someone else. Nobody she remembered. And the world was wrapped in a warm light that would keep her safe forever. The stinging taste of salt was in her mouth. But it wasn't just the water from the tank. She was weeping now, too, watching the path through the shimmering curtain of her tears, holding Amy fiercely as she ran. Then she saw it. The snack stand. It appeared before her like a beacon, the snack stand with the big umbrella where she had bought the peanuts, and beyond it, standing open like a mouth, the wide gate of the exit. Guards in their yellow jerseys were barking into their walkie-talkies and waving people frantically through. Lacey took a deep breath and moved into the crowd, holding Amy to her chest. She was just a few feet from the exit when a hand gripped her arm. She turned sharply. One of the guards. With his free hand, he gestured over her head to someone else, his grip tightening. "Lacey. Lacey." "Ma'am? Please come with me." She didn't wait. With a shove, she pushed forward with all the strength she had left, felt the crowd bending. Behind her, she heard the grunts and cries of people falling as she broke free, and the guard calling out for her to stop. But they were through the gate now, Lacey tearing down the pathway into the parking lot and the sound of sirens drawing near. She was sweating and breathing hard and knew that at any moment she could fall. She didn't know where she was going, but it didn't matter. Away, she thought. Away. Run as fast as you can, children. Away with Amy. Away. Then, from behind her, somewhere in the zoo, she heard a rifle shot. The sound cleaved the air, freezing Lacey in her tracks. In the sudden silence of its aftermath, a van pulled up, skidding to a stop in front of her. Amy had gone limp against her chest. It was their van, Lacey saw, the one the sisters used, the big blue van they drove to the pantry and to run errands. Sister Claire was driving, still in her sweats. A second vehicle, a black sedan, pulled in behind them as Sister Arnett burst from the van's passenger seat. Around them the crowds were streaming past. Cars were zooming out of the lot.
Lacey, what in the world?
Two men emerged from the second vehicle. Darkness poured off them. Lacey's heart clenched. Her voice stopped in her throat like a cork. She didn't have to look to know what they were.
Too late. All lost. No.
She was backing away.
No.
Arnett gripped her by the arm.
Sister, get a hold of yourself.
People were pulling at her. Hands were trying to wriggle the child free. With every ounce of strength, Lacey held fast, squeezing the child to her chest.
Don't let them, she cried. Help me. Sister Lacey, these men are from the FBI. Please, do as they ask. Don't take her.
Lacey was on the ground now.
Don't take her! Don't take her!
It was Arnett, after all. It was Sister Arnett who was taking Amy from her. As it had been in the field, Lacey kicking and fighting and screaming.
Amy! Amy!
She shook with a huge sob then, the last of her strength leaving her body in a rush. A space opened around her as she felt Amy lifted away. She heard the girl's small voice crying out to her,
Lacey, Lacey, Lacey!
And then the muffling clap of the car's doors as Amy was sealed away inside. She heard the sound of an engine, wheels turning, a car pulling away at high speed. Her face was in her hands.
Don't take me. Don't take me,
she was sobbing.
Don't take me. Don't take me. Don't take me.
Claire was beside her now. She put an arm around Lacey's shaking shoulders.
Sister, it's all right,
she said, and Lacey could tell she was crying too.
It's all right. You're safe now.
But it wasn't. She wasn't. No one was safe. Not Lacey, or Claire, or Arnett, or the woman with the baby, or the guard in his yellow shirt. Lacey knew that now. How could Claire tell her everything was all right? Because it wasn't all right. That was what the voices had been saying to her all these years, since that night in the field when she was just a girl. Lacey Antoinette Kudoto. Listen. Look. In her mind's eye, she saw it. Saw it all at last. The rolling armies and the flames of battle, the graves and pits and dying cries of 100 million souls, the spreading darkness like a black wing stretching over the earth, the last bitter hours of cruelty and sorrow and terrible final flights, death's great dominion over all, and at the last, the empty cities, becalmed by the silence of 100 years. Already these things were coming to pass. Lacey wept, and wept some more, because sitting on the curb in Memphis, Tennessee, she saw Amy, too. Her Amy, whom Lacey could not save, as she could not save herself. Amy, time stilled and nameless, wandering the forgotten, lightless world forever, alone and voiceless. But for this, what I am, what I am, what I am. Chapter 7. Carter was someplace cold. That was the first thing he could tell. They took him off the plane first. Carter had never been on a plane in his life and would have liked to have had a window seat, but they'd stuffed him in the back with all the rucksacks, his left wrist chained to a pipe and two soldiers to watch him. And as he stepped onto the stairs leading down to the tarmac, the cold hit his lungs like a slap. Carter had been cold before. You couldn't sleep under a Houston freeway in January and not know what cold was. But the cold here was different, so dry he could feel his lips puckering. His ears had clogged up, too. It was late. Who knew how late, exactly? But the airfield was lit like a jail yard. From the top of the stairs, Carter counted a dozen aircraft, big fat ones with huge doors dropped open at the back like a kid's pajamas, and forklifts moving to and fro along the tarmac, loading pallets draped with camo. He wondered if maybe they were going to make some kind of soldier out of him, if that's what he'd traded his life for. Wolgast. He remembered the name. It was funny how he'd found himself trusting the man. Carter hadn't trusted anyone in a long, long time. But there was something about Wolgast that made him think the man knew the place he was in. Carter's wrists and feet were shackled, and he made his way gingerly down the stairs, minding his balance, one soldier ahead of him, one behind. Neither had spoken a word to him or even to each other that Carter could tell. He was wearing a parka over his jumpsuit, but it was unzipped for the chains, and the wind cut through him easily. They led him across the field toward a brightly lit hangar where a van was idling. The door slid open as they approached. The first soldier poked him with his rifle. "In you go." Carter did as he said, then heard a small motor whir and the door closed behind him. At least the seats were comfortable, not like the hard bench on the airplane. The only light was from a little bulb in the ceiling. He heard two thumps on the door and the van pulled away. He dozed on the plane and wasn't tired enough to sleep more. With no windows and no way to tell the time, he had no sense of distance or direction. But he'd sat still for whole months of his life. A few hours more wasn't anything he couldn't do. He let his mind go blank for a while. Time passed, and then he felt the van slowing. From the other side of the wall that sealed him from the driver's compartment came the muffled sound of voices, but Carter didn't know what it was all about. The van lurched forward and stopped again. The door slid open to show two soldiers stamping their feet in the cold, white boys wearing parkas over their fatigues. Behind the soldiers, the brightly lit oasis of a McDonald's throbbed in the gloom. Carter heard the rush of traffic and figured they were by a highway somewhere. Though it was still dark, something about the sky felt like morning. His legs and arms were stiff from sitting. "Here," one of the guards said, and tossed him a bag. He noticed then that the other guard was biting into the last of a sandwich. "Breakfast." Carter opened the bag, which contained an Egg McMuffin and a disc of hash browns wrapped in paper and a plastic cup of juice. His throat was bone dry from the cold, and he wished there was more of the juice or even just water to drink. He drained it quickly. It was so sugary it made his teeth tingle. "Thank you." The soldier yawned into his hand. Carter wondered why they were being so nice. They didn't seem at all like Pincher and the rest of them. They were wearing sidearms, but didn't act like this was anything. "We've got a couple of hours yet," the soldier said as Carter finished eating. "You need to make a pit stop." Carter hadn't peed since the plane, but he was so dried out he didn't figure there was much in him to go with. He'd always been like that, could hold it for hours and hours. But he thought about the McDonald's, the people inside, the smell of food and the bright lights, and knew he wanted to see it.
I reckon so.
The soldier climbed into the van, his heavy boots clanging on the metal floor. Crouching in the tiny space, he removed a shiny key from a pouch on his belt and unlocked the shackles. Anthony could see his face up close. He had red hair and wasn't no more than 20, give or take. No funny stuff, understand, he told Anthony. We're not really supposed to do this.
No, sir.
Here, zip up your coat. It's fucking freezing out here. They led him across the parking lot, one on either side, but not touching him. Carter couldn't remember when he'd gone anywhere without somebody else's hand on him someplace. Most of the cars in the lot had Colorado plates. The air smelled clean, like pine saw, and he felt the presence of mountains around him, pressing down. There was snow on the ground, too, piled high against the edges of the lot and crusted with ice. He'd only seen snow once or twice in his life. The soldiers knocked on the bathroom door, and when nobody answered, they let Carter inside. One came in while the other watched the door. There were two urinals, and Carter took one. The soldier who was with him took the other. "Hands where I can see 'em," the soldier said, and laughed. "Just kidding." Carter finished up and stepped to the sink to wash. The McDonald's he remembered from Houston were pretty dirty, especially the restrooms. When he was living on the street, he used to use one up in Montrose to wash up once in a while, until the manager caught on and chased him away. But this one was nice and clean, with flowery-smelling soap and a little potted plant sitting beside the sink. He washed his hands, taking his time, letting the warm water flow over his skin.
"They got plants in McDonald's now?" he asked the soldier.
The soldier gave him a puzzled look, then burst into laughter.
"How long you been away?"
Carter didn't know what was so funny.
"Most my life," he said.
When they exited the bathroom, the first soldier was standing in line, so the three of them waited together. Neither had so much as laid a hand on him. Carter took a slow look around the room. A couple of men sitting alone, a family or two, a woman with a teenage boy who was playing a handheld video game. Everyone was white. They got to the counter and the soldier ordered coffee. "You need anything else?" he asked Carter. Carter thought a moment.
"They got iced tea here."
"You got iced tea?" the soldier asked the girl behind the counter. She shrugged. She was loudly chewing gum. "Hot tea." The soldier looked at Carter, who shook his head. "Just the coffee." The soldiers were Paulson and Davis. They introduced themselves when they got back to the van. One was from Connecticut, the other one from New Mexico, though Carter got them confused, and he didn't figure it made much difference, since he'd never been to either place. Davis was the one with the red hair. For the rest of the drive, they left open the little window that connected the two compartments in the van. They left the shackles off, too. They were in Colorado, like he'd guessed, but whenever they came to a road sign, the soldiers told him to cover his eyes, laughing like this was a big joke. After a time, they got off the interstate and took a rural highway that wound tight against the mountains. Sitting on the front bench of the passenger compartment, Carter could view a bit of the passing world through the windshield. Snow was piled steeply against the roadsides. There were no towns at all that Carter could see. Only once in a while did a car approach them from the other direction, a blaze of light followed by the splash of melted snow as it passed. He'd never been any place like this, that had so few people in it. The clock on the dash said it was a little after 6 a.m.
"Cold up here," Carter said.
Paulson was driving. The other one, Davis, was reading a comic book.
"You got that right," said Paulson. "Colder than Beth Pope's back brace." "Who Beth Pope?"
Paulson shrugged, peering over the wheel. "Girl I knew in high school. She had What's that thing? Scoliosis. Carter didn't know what that was either, but Paulson and Davis thought it was funny enough. If the job Walgast had for him meant working with these two, he'd be glad to do it. That Aquaman? Carter asked Davis. Davis passed him a couple of comic books from the pile, A League of Vengeance and an X-Men. It was too dark to read the words, but Carter liked looking at the pictures, which told the story anyway. That Wolverine was a badass. Carter had always liked him, though he always felt sorry for him, too. It couldn't be no fun having all that metal in your bones, and somebody he cared about was always dying or getting killed. After another hour or so, Paulson pulled the van over. "Sorry, dude," he told Carter. "We've got to lock you up again." "It's all right," Carter said and nodded. "I appreciate the time." Davis climbed out of the passenger seat and came around back. The door opened to a blast of cold air. Davis redid the shackles and pocketed the key. "Comfortable?" Carter nodded. "How much longer we got to go?" "Not much," he said. They drove on. Carter could tell they were climbing now. He couldn't see the sky, but guessed it would be light soon. As they slowed to cross a long bridge, wind buffeted the van. They had reached the other side when Paulson met his eyes through the rear view. "You know, you don't seem like the others," he said. "What you do, anyway. You don't mind my asking."
"Who the others?"
"You know, other guys like you. Cons." He swiveled his head to Davis. "Remember that guy Babcock?" He shook his head and laughed. "Christ on a stick, what a whack job." He looked at Carter again. "He wasn't like you, that guy. I can tell you're different."
"I ain't crazy," Carter said. "Judge said I wasn't."
"But you did somebody, right? Else you wouldn't be here now." Carter wondered if talking like this was something he had to do, if it was part of the deal.
"They said I killed a lady. But I didn't mean to."
"Who was she? Wife? Girlfriend? Something like that?" Paulson was still grinning at him in the rear view, his eyes flashing with interest.
"No."
Carter swallowed.
"I cut the lady's lawn."
Paulson laughed and glanced at Davis again.
"Listen to this. He cut the lady's lawn."
He looked at Carter through the mirror again.
"Little guy like you, how'd you do it?"
Carter didn't know what to say. He had a bad feeling now, like maybe they'd been nice to him just to mess with his head.
"Come on, Anthony. We got you a McMuffin, right? Took you to the bathroom? You can tell us."
"For fuck's sakes," Davis said to Paulson. "Just shut up. We're almost there. What's the point?" "The point is," Paulson said and drew in a breath,
"I want to know what this guy did. They all did something. Come on, Anthony, what's your story? You rape her before you did her? Was that it?"
Carter felt his face go hot with shame.
"I wouldn't never do that,"
he managed. Davis turned to Carter. "Don't listen to this douchebag. You don't have to say anything."
"Come on, the dude's retarded. Can't you see that?"
Paulson eyed Carter eagerly through the mirror again.
"I bet that's what happened, isn't it? I bet you fucked the nice white lady whose lawn you were cutting, didn't you, Anthony?"
Carter felt the air stick in his throat.
"I ain't saying no more."
"You know what they're gonna do with you?" Paulson asked. "You thought maybe this was all a free ride?"
"God damn it! Zip your mouth," Davis said. "Richards will have both our asses for this."
"Yeah, fuck him too," Paulson said.
"Man said I got a job," Anthony managed. "Said it was important. Said I special."
"Special?"
Paulson snickered over the word.
You're special, all right. They drove on in silence. Carter looked at the floor of the van, feeling dizzy and sick to his stomach. He wished now he'd never eaten the McMuffin. He'd begun to cry. Didn't know when he'd done that last. Nobody had ever said anything about raping the woman, not that he recalled. They'd asked about the girl, but he'd always said no, which was the God's truth. He swore it. The little thing weren't no more than 5 years old. He'd just been trying to show her a toad he found in the grass. He thought she'd like to see something like that, something tiny, like she was. That's all he'd meant to do. Nice. Ain't nobody ever done things like that for him when he was a boy. Come here, honey. I got something to show you. Just a little bit of a thing like you. At least he'd known what Terrell was, what was going to happen to him there. Nobody'd said nothing about raping the lady, Mrs. Wood. That day in the yard, she'd gone just flat-out crazy on him, screaming and hitting, telling the little girl to run, and it wasn't his fault she'd fallen in. He'd just been trying to make her calm down, tell her nothing had happened. He'd go away and never come back if that's what she wanted. He'd been okay with that, and okay with the rest, too, when it came down to it. But then Wolgast had showed up and told him he didn't have to go to the Needle after all, turning Carter's mind in another direction, and now look where he was. There weren't no sense in any of it. It made him sick and shaky to his bones. He lifted his head to find Paulson grinning at him. The whites of his eyes widened. Boo! Paulson slapped the wheel and burst into laughter like he'd just told the best joke of his life. Then he slammed the window shut. Wolgast and Doyle were somewhere in South Memphis now, working their way out of the city's suburban ring through a warren of residential streets. The whole thing had gone bad from the start. Wolgast had no idea what in the hell had been going on at the zoo. The whole place was going berserk. And then the woman, the old nun, Arnett, had just about tackled the other one, Lacey, to get the girl out of her hands. The girl. Amy N.L.N. She couldn't have been more than 6 years old. Wolgast had been ready to pull the plug, but then she'd let the girl go, and the old one handed her off to Doyle, who carried her to the car before Wolgast could get in another word. After that, there was nothing to do but get out of there as fast as they could before the locals showed up and started asking questions. Who knew how many witnesses there'd been? It had all happened too fast. He had to dump the car. He had to call Sykes. He had to get them out of Tennessee, all in that order, and he had to do it now. Amy was lying across the back seat, facing away, clutching the stuffed rabbit she'd gotten out of her backpack. Sweet Jesus, what had he done? A 6-year-old girl. In a dreary neighborhood of apartments and strip malls, Wolgast pulled into a gas station and shut off the engine. He turned to Doyle. The two of them hadn't spoken since the zoo. What the hell is wrong with you?
Brad, listen, are you crazy? Look at her. She's a kid. It just kinda happened.
Doyle shook his head.
Everything was so crazy.
Okay, maybe I fucked up, I admit that. But what was I supposed to do? Wolgast breathed deeply, trying to calm himself.
Wait here.
He stepped from the car and punched in the code for Sykes's secure line.
We've got a problem.
You have her?
Yes, we have her. She's a child. What the fuck?
Agent, I know you're angry. You're goddamn right I'm angry. And we had about 50 witnesses, starting with the nuns. I feel like dropping her off at the nearest cop shop. Sykes was silent a moment.
I need you to focus, Agent. Let's just get you out of state. Then we'll figure out what happens next.
Nothing's going to happen next. This is not what I signed on for.
I can hear you're upset. You have a right to be.
Where are you?
Wargas took a deep breath, bringing his anger under control.
At a gas station. South Memphis.
Is she all right?
Physically. Don't do anything stupid. Are you threatening me?
But even as he said the words, Wargas knew with a sudden, icy clarity what the situation was. The moment to break ranks had passed at the zoo. They were all fugitives now.
I don't have to, Sykes said. Wait for my call.
Wargast clicked off the phone and stepped into the station. The attendant, a trim Indian man in a turban, was sitting behind the bulletproof glass, watching a church show on TV. The girl was probably hungry. Wargast got some peanut butter crackers and some chocolate milk and took it to the counter. He was looking up, noticing the cameras, when his handheld buzzed at his waist. He paid quickly and stepped outside.
I can get you a car out of Little Rock, Sykes said. Somebody from the field office can meet you if you give me an address.
Little Rock was at least 2 hours. Too long. Two men in suits, a little girl, a black sedan so plain it couldn't have been more obvious. The nuns had probably given the plate number, too. There was no way they could go through the scanner on the bridge. If the girl had been reported as a kidnap victim, the Amber Alert system would be activated. Wargast looked around. Across the avenue he saw a used car lot, strings of multicolored banners fluttering above it. Most of the cars were junk, old gas guzzlers nobody could afford to fill anymore. An old-style Chevy Tahoe, 10 years if it was a day, was parked to face the street. The words easy financing were stenciled on the windshield. Wargast told Sykes what he wanted to do. At the car, he gave Doyle the milk and crackers for Amy and jogged across the avenue. A man with huge eyeglasses and a flapping comb-over stepped from the trailer as Wargast approached the Tahoe.
A beaut, isn't she?
He got the man down to 6 grand, which was nearly all the cash he had left. Sykes would have to see to the money question, too. Because today was a Saturday, the paperwork on the Tahoe wouldn't hit the DMV computers until Monday morning. By then, they'd be long gone. Doyle followed him to an apartment complex about a mile away. Doyle parked the car in back, away from the road, and carried Amy to the Tahoe. Not perfect, but as long as Sykes got somebody to ghost the car by the end of the day, they'd be untraceable. The inside of the Tahoe smelled too strongly of lemon air freshener, but it was otherwise clean and comfortable. And the mileage on the odometer wasn't bad, a little over 90,000.
How much cash do you have? He asked Doyle.
They put their money together. They had a little over $300 left. It would cost at least $200 to fill the tank, but that would get them to western Arkansas, maybe as far as Oklahoma. Somebody could meet them with cash, and a new vehicle, too. They crossed back into Mississippi and turned west toward the river. The day was clear, just a few clouds ribboning the sky. In the back seat, Amy was motionless as a stone. She hadn't touched the food. She was just a little bit of a thing. A baby. The whole thing gave Wargast a sick feeling in his stomach. The Tahoe was a rolling crime scene. But for now, he had to get them out of the state. Beyond that, Wargast didn't know. By the time they were approaching the bridge, it was nearly 1 o'clock.
You think we're okay? Doyle asked.
Wargast kept his eyes straight ahead.
We'll find out.
The gates were open, the guardhouse unmanned. They sailed through easily, across the wide girth of the muddy river, swollen with spring runoff. Below them, a long line of barges pushed obliviously northward against the foaming current. The scanner would log their vehicle signature, but the car would still be registered to the dealer. It would take days to sort it all out, to check the video stream and connect them to the girl and the car. On the far side, the road reclined to the open fields of the western floodplain, sodden with moisture. Wargast had thought about the route carefully. They wouldn't hit a good-sized town until they were nearly to Little Rock. He set the cruise control for 55, the posted limit, and headed north again, wondering how it was that Sykes had known just what he'd do. By the time the van bringing Anthony Carter pulled into the compound, Richards was asleep in his office, his head on his desk. His comm buzzed to wake him. It was the guardhouse, telling him Paulson and Davis were outside. He rubbed his eyes, brought his mind into focus. Bring him straight in. He decided to let Sykes sleep. He stood and stretched, called for a member of the medical staff and a security detail to meet him, then put on his jacket and took the stairs up to ground level. The loading dock stood at the rear of the building, on the south side facing the woods, and beyond that, the river gorge. The compound had once been some kind of institute, a retreat for corporate executives and government officials. Richards was a little vague on the history. The place had been closed up for at least 10 years before special weapons had taken it over. Cole had ordered the chalet dismantled piece by piece to excavate the lower levels and build the power plant. They'd then rebuilt the exterior almost exactly as it had been. Richards stepped into the gloom and cold. A wide roof was suspended over the concrete dock, keeping the surface clear of snow and obstructing the view from the rest of the compound. He checked his watch. 0712. By now, he figured, Anthony Carter would be a psychological wreck. With the other subjects, there had been time for adjustment. But Carter had been plucked straight off death row and landed here in less than a day. His mind would be tumbling like a dryer. The important thing in the next 2 hours was to keep him calm. The space swelled with the headlights of the approaching van. Richards descended the steps as the security detail, two soldiers wearing sidearms, jogged in and out of the snow. Richards told them to keep their distance and leave their weapons holstered. He'd read Carter's file and doubted he'd be violent. The guy was basically as gentle as a lamb. Paulson killed the engine and climbed from the van. There was a keypad on the van's sliding door. He punched in the numbers and Richards watched it draw slowly open. Carter was sitting on the front bench. His head was tipped forward, but Richards could see that his eyes were open. His hands, shackled, lay folded in his lap. Richards saw a crumpled McDonald's bag on the floor at his feet. At least they'd fed him. The window between the compartments was closed. Anthony Carter? No response. Richards called his name again. Nothing. Not a twitch. Carter seemed completely catatonic. Richards stepped back from the door and pulled Paulson aside. Okay, you tell me, he said. What's the story? Paulson gave a stagey, who me? Shrug. Beats me. Dude's just fucked up or something. Don't bullshit me, son. Richards turned his attention to the other one with the red hair. Davis. He was holding a sheaf of comic books in his hand. Comic books, for the love of God. For the 1000th time, Richards thought it. These were kids. What about you, soldier? He asked Davis. Sir? Don't play stupid. You got anything to say for yourself? Davis's eyes darted toward Paulson, then back to Richards. No, sir. He'd deal with these two later. Richards stepped back toward the van. Carter hadn't moved a muscle. Richards could see that his nose was running. His cheeks were streaked with tears. Anthony, my name is Richards. I'm the head of security at this facility. These two boys aren't going to bother you anymore, you hear me?
We didn't do anything, Paulson pleaded. It was just a joke. Hey, Anthony, can't you take a joke?
Richards turned sharply to face them again.
That little voice in your head, telling you to shut the fuck up? That's the voice you should be listening to right about now.
Oh, come on, Paulson whined. The dude's mental or something. Anyone can see that.
Richards felt the last of his patience run out of him like the last drops of water from a leaky bucket. The hell with it. Without speaking, he withdrew his weapon from its spot at the base of his spine. A long-slide Springfield 45 that he used mostly for show. A huge gun. A hilarious gun. But despite its bulk, it rode comfortably, and in the pre-dawn light of the loading area, its titanium casing radiated with the menace of its perfect mechanical efficiency. In a single motion, Richards popped the safety with his thumb and chambered around, grasping Paulson by the belt buckle to pull him close, then shoved the muzzle into the soft V of flesh below his chin.
"Don't you understand," Richards said quietly, "that I'd shoot you right here just to put a smile on this man's face?"
Paulson's body had gone rigid. He was trying to cast his eyes toward Davis, or maybe the security detail, but was facing the wrong way.
"What the fuck?"
he sputtered against the clenching muscles of his throat. He swallowed hard, his Adam's apple bobbing up against the muzzle of the gun.
"I'm cool. I'm cool."
"Anthony," Richard said,
his eyes still fixed on Paulson's.
"It's your call, my friend. You tell me. Is he cool?"
From the van, a long silence. Then quietly,
"It's all right. He cool."
"You're sure now? Because if he isn't, I want you to tell me. You get the last word on this."
Another pause.
"He cool?"
"You hear that?"
Richard said to Paulson. He released the soldier's belt and pulled his weapon away.
"The man says you're cool."
Paulson looked like he was about to cry for his mama. On the loading dock, the security detail burst out laughing.
"The key," Richard said.
Paulson reached into his belt and passed it to Richards. His hands were trembling. His breath smelled like vomit.
"Go on now," Richard said.
He shot a look at Davis, holding his pile of comic books.
"You too, Junior. The both of you, get the fuck out of here."
They scrambled off into the snow. In the few minutes since the van had pulled up, the sun had lifted from behind the mountains, giving the air a pale glow. Richards bent into the van and undid Carter's shackles.
"You okay? Those boys hurt you anywhere?"
Carter rubbed his damp face.
"They didn't mean nothing."
He swung his feet from the bench and lowered himself stiffly onto the ground. He blinked and looked around.
"They're gone?"
Richards said they were.
"What this place?"
"Fair question."
Richards nodded.
"All in time."
"You hungry, Anthony?"
"They fed me."
"McDonald's." Carter's eyes found the security detail, standing on the dock above them. His expression told Richards nothing.
"What about them?"
he asked.
"They're here for you. You're the guest of honor, Anthony."
Carter narrowed his eyes at Richards.
"You really shoot that guy if I'd said to?"
Something about Carter made him think of Sykes, standing in his office with that lost look on his face, asking him if they were friends.
"What do you think?"
"You think I would have?"
"I wouldn't know what to think."
"Well, just between us. No, I wouldn't have. I was just fooling with him."
"I thought you was."
Carter's face broke into a grin.
"Thought it was funny, though. You doing him like you did."
He shook his head, laughing a little, and looked around again.
"What happened now?"
"What happens now," Richard said, "is we get you inside, where it's warm."
Chapter 8 By nightfall, they were 50 miles past Oklahoma City, hurtling west across the open prairie toward a wall of spring thunderheads ascending from the horizon like a bank of blooming flowers in a time-lapse video. Doyle was fast asleep in the Tahoe's passenger seat, his head wedged into the space between the headrest and the window, cushioned against the bumps in the road by a folded jacket.
At times like this, Walgast found himself envying Doyle, his powers of oblivion. He could turn his own lights off like a 10-year-old, put his head down and sleep virtually anywhere. Walgast's fatigue was deep. He knew the smart thing would have been to pull off and change places, catch a few winks himself. But he had driven the whole distance from Memphis, and the feel of the wheel in his hands was the only thing that made him think he still had a card to play. Since his call to Sykes, their only contact had taken place in a truck stop parking lot outside Little Rock, where a field agent had met them with an envelope of cash. $3,000, all in 20s and 50s, and a fresh vehicle, a plain wrapper bureau sedan. But by then Walgast had decided he liked the Tahoe and wanted to keep it. He liked its big, muscular 8-cylinder engine and swishy steering and bouncy suspension. He hadn't driven anything like it in years. It seemed a pity to send a vehicle like that into the crusher, and when the agent offered him the keys to the sedan, he waved them off imperiously, without a second thought. "Is there anything on the wires about us?" he'd asked the agent, a fresh recruit with a face pink as a slice of ham. The agent frowned with confusion. "I don't know anything about it." Walgast considered this. "Good," he said finally. "He'll want to keep it that way." The agent had then taken him around to the sedan's trunk, which sprang open to meet them. Inside was the black nylon duffel bag he hadn't asked for, but still expected. "Keep it," he said. "You sure? I'm supposed to give it to you." Walgast shifted his gaze toward the Tahoe, parked at the edge of the lot between two dozing semis. Through the rear window he could see Doyle, but not the girl, who was lying down on the back seat. He really wanted to get moving. Whatever else was true, sitting still was not an option. As for the bag, maybe he needed it and maybe he didn't. But the decision to leave it behind felt right. "Tell the office anything you want," he said. "What I could really use is some coloring books."
"I'm sorry?"
Walgast would have laughed if he were in the mood. He put his palm on the lid of the trunk and pushed it closed. "Never mind," he said. The bag held guns, of course, and ammunition, and maybe a couple of armored vests. Probably there'd be one in there for the girl, too. There was a company in Ohio that was making them for kids now, since that thing in Minneapolis. Walgast had caught a segment about it on the Today Show. They were actually making a Zylon snapsuit for infants. What a world, he thought. Now, Little Rock 6 hours behind them, he was still glad he'd declined the bag. Whatever happened, happened. Part of him wanted to be stopped. Outside Little Rock, he'd actually let the speedometer drift up to 80, only dimly aware of what he was doing. That he was daring some state trooper or even a local cop sitting behind a billboard to call the whole thing off. But then Doyle had told him to slow down. "Yo, Chief, shouldn't you ease off the pedal a bit?" And his mind had snapped back into focus. He'd actually been playing out the scene in his mind. The flashing lights and a single tart bleep of the siren. Pulling the truck over to the side and placing his open hands on the wheel, lifting his eyes to the rear view to watch the officer calling in the plate number on his radio. 2 grown men and a minor in a vehicle with temporary Tennessee tags. It wouldn't take long to put the whole thing together, to connect them to the nun and the zoo. Whenever he imagined the scene, he couldn't see beyond that moment. The cop with one hand on his mic, the other resting on the butt of his weapon. What would Sykes do? Would he say he'd never even heard of them? No. He and Doyle would go into the shredder, just like Anthony Carter. As for the girl, he didn't know. They'd skirted the Oklahoma City limits to the northeast, dodging the Interstate 40 checkpoint and bisecting I-35 on an anonymous rural blacktop, far from any cameras. The Tahoe lacked a GPS, but Walgast had one on his handheld. Guiding the steering wheel with one hand, nimbly thumbing away on the handheld's tiny keys with the other,
He let their route evolve as they went, a patchwork of county and state roads, some gravel or even just hard-packed dirt to carry them gradually north and west. Now all that lay between them and the Colorado border were a few small towns, towns with names like Virgil and Ricochet and Buckrack, half-abandoned oases in a sea of tall grass prairie with little to show for themselves but a mini-mart, a couple of churches, a grain elevator, and between them, the miles of open plain. Flyover country. The word it made him think of was eternal. He guessed it looked much the same as it always had, the way it would go on looking just about forever. A man could disappear into a place like this without hardly trying, live his life without one soul to notice. Maybe, Walgast thought, when this was all over, he'd come back. He might need a place like that. Amy was so quiet in the back seat it might have been possible to forget she was there at all, if not for the fact that everything about her being there was wrong. A 6-year-old girl. Goddamn Sykes, Walgast thought. Goddamn the Bureau. Goddamn Doyle, and goddamn himself while he was at it. Lying across the wide back seat with her hair spilled over her cheek, Amy looked as if she were sleeping, but Walgast didn't think she was. She was pretending, watching him like a cat. Whatever had happened in her life so far, it had taught her how to wait. Whenever Walgast had asked her if she needed to stop to use the bathroom or get something to eat, she hadn't touched the crackers and milk, warm and spoiled by now. The lids of her eyes had lifted with a feline quickness at the sound of her name, meeting his gaze in the mirror for a single second that went through him like a 3-foot icicle. Then she'd shut them again. He hadn't heard her voice since the zoo, more than 8 hours ago. Lacey. That was the nun's name, who'd held on to Amy like death itself. When Walgast thought about that awful human tug-of-war in the parking lot, everyone yelling and screaming, the memory twisted in his gut with an actual physical pain. Hey, Lila. Guess what? I stole a kid today. So now we'll each have one. How about that? Doyle was rousing in the passenger seat. He sat up and rubbed his eyes, his expression blank and focusless. His mind, Walgast knew, was reassembling his awareness of where he was. He looked back at Amy quickly, then turned to face forward again. "Looks like some weather ahead," he said. The thunderheads had risen to a boil, blocking the sunset and sinking them into a premature darkness. At the horizon, beneath a shelf of clouds, a haze of rain was falling through a band of golden sunlight onto the fields. Doyle leaned forward to examine the sky through the windshield. His voice was quiet. "How far away you think that is?"
"I guess about 5 miles."
"Maybe we should get off the road."
Doyle checked his watch.
"Or turn south for a while."
2 miles later, they passed an unmarked dirt road, its edges lined with barbed wire fencing. Walgast stopped the car and backed up. The road crested a gentle rise and vanished into a line of cottonwoods. Probably there was a river on the other side of the hill, or at least a gully. Walgast checked the GPS. The road wasn't on it.
"I don't know," Doyle said when Walgast showed him. "Maybe we should look for something else."
Walgast turned the wheel of the Tahoe and headed south. He didn't think the road was a dead end. There would have been postal boxes at the intersection if it were. 300 yards later, the road narrowed to a single lane of rutted dirt. Beyond the tree line, they crossed an old wooden bridge that spanned the creek Walgast had foreseen. The evening light had gone a sallow green. He could see the storm rising above the horizon in his rearview mirror. He knew, from the blowing tips of the ditch grass on either side, that it was following them. They had traveled another 10 miles when the rain started to fall. They'd passed no houses or farms. They were in the middle of nowhere, with no cover. First, just a few drops, but then within seconds, a downpour of such force that Walgast couldn't see a thing.
The wipers were useless. He pulled to the edge of the ditch as a huge gust of wind buffeted the car.
"What now, Chief?" Doyle asked over the racket.
Walgast looked at Amy, still pretending to sleep in the back seat. Thunder roiled overhead. She didn't flinch.
"Wait, I guess. I'm going to rest a minute."
Walgast closed his eyes, listening to the rain on the roof of the Tahoe. He let the sound wash through him. He'd learned to do this during those months with Eva, to rest without quite giving himself over to sleep, so that he could rise quickly and go to her crib if she awakened. Scattered memories began to gather in his mind, pictures and sensations from other times in his life. Lila in the kitchen of the house in Cherry Creek, on a morning not long after they'd bought the place, pouring milk into a bowl of cereal. The cold dousing of water as he dove from the pier in Coos Bay, the sounds of his friends' voices above him, laughing and urging him on. The feeling of being very small himself, no more than a baby, and the noises and lights of the world around him, all of it letting him know he was safe. He had entered sleep's antechamber, the place where dreams and memories mingled, telling their strange stories. Yet part of him was still in the car, listening to the rain.
"I have to go."
His eyes snapped open. The rain had stopped. How long had he slept? The car was dark. The sun had set. Doyle was twisted at the waist, turned to face the back seat.
"What did you say?" Doyle asked. "I have to go," the little girl stated. Her voice, after hours of silence, was startling, clear and forceful.
"To the bathroom." Doyle looked at Walgast nervously.
"Want me to take her?" he said, though Walgast knew he didn't want to.
"Not you," Amy said. She was sitting up now, holding her rabbit. It was a floppy thing, filthy with wear. She eyed Walgast in the mirror, lifted her hand and pointed.
"Him."
Walgast undid his seatbelt and stepped from the Tahoe. The air was cool and still. He could see, to the southeast, the last of the storm receding, leaving in its wake a dry sky the color of ink, a deep blue-black. He hit the key fob to unlock the passenger door and Amy climbed out. She had zipped the front of her sweatshirt and pulled the hood up over her head.
"Okay?" he asked. "I'm not doing it here."
Walgast didn't say anything about not wandering off. There seemed no point. Where would she go? He led her 50 feet down the roadway, away from the lights of the Tahoe. Walgast looked away while she stood at the edge of the ditch and pulled down her jeans.
"I need help."
Walgast turned. She was facing him, her jeans and underpants bunched around her ankles. He felt his face warm with embarrassment.
"What do you need me to do?"
She held out both her hands. Her fingers felt tiny in his own. Her palms were moist with childlike heat. He had to hold tightly as she leaned back, giving him nearly all her weight to position herself in a crouch, suspending her body out over the ditch like a piano swinging from a crane. Where had she learned to do this? Who else had held her hands this way? When she was done, he turned around so she could pull her pants back up.
"You don't have to be afraid, honey."
Amy said nothing. She made no motion to return to the Tahoe. Around them, the fields were empty, the air absolutely still, as if caught between breaths. Walgast could feel it, the emptiness of the fields, the thousands of miles they spread in every direction. He heard the front door of the Tahoe open and slam closed. Doyle, going off to take a leak himself. Far off to the south, he heard a distant echo of thunder rolling away, and in the clear, aural space behind it, a new sound. A kind of tinkling, like bells.
"We can be friends if you want," he ventured.
"Would that be okay?" She was a strange girl, he thought again. Why hadn't she cried? Because she hadn't. Not since the zoo, and she'd never asked for her mother, or said she wanted to go home, or even back to the convent. Where was home for her? Memphis, maybe. But he had the feeling it wasn't. No place was. Whatever had happened to the girl had taken the idea of home away. Then, I'm not afraid. We can go back to the car if you want. For a moment she just looked at him, in that evaluating way of hers. His ears had adjusted to the silence, and he was certain now that it was music he was hearing, the sound distorted by distance. Somewhere, down the road they were driving on, somebody was playing music. I'm Brad. The name felt bland and heavy in his mouth. She nodded. The other man? He's Phil. I know who you are. I heard you talking. She shifted her weight. You thought I wasn't listening. But I was. A spooky kid. And smart, too. He could hear it in her voice, see it in the way she was sizing him up with her eyes, using the silence to appraise him, to draw him out. He felt as if he were speaking with somebody much older, though not exactly. He couldn't put his finger on what the difference was. What's in Colorado? That's where we're going. I heard you say it. Walgast wasn't sure how much to say. Well, there's a doctor there. He's going to look at you. Like a checkup. I'm not sick. That's why, I think. I don't really know. He winced inwardly at the lie. You don't have to be afraid. Don't keep saying that. He was so taken aback by her directness that for a moment he said nothing. Okay. That's good. I'm glad you're not. Because I'm not afraid, Amy declared and began walking toward the lights of the Tahoe. You are. A few miles later, they saw it up ahead, a dome-like zone of thrumming light that sorted as they approached into discrete orbiting points, like a family of constellations spinning low against the horizon. Just as Walgast figured out what he was seeing, the road ended at an intersection. He turned on the overhead light and checked the GPS. A line of cars and pickup trucks, more than they had seen in hours, was passing on the highway, all headed in the same direction. He opened his window to the night air. The sound of music was unmistakable now. "What is that?" Doyle asked. Walgast said nothing. He turned west, threading into the line of traffic. In the bed of the pickup ahead of them, a group of teenagers, about a half dozen, were sitting on bales of